The Capital Confidential podcast is brought to you by the Times Union, the leading newspaper in New York's Capital Region. Subscribe today or visit online at timesunion.com.
We'll edit that out. Cough again, you know.
Sorry.
And feel free to curse, too. We need a Diane Savino figure here.
You want to deport an undocumented person? Start with me, because I'm an undocumented person.
How do we beat him in an election?
We will. I'm going to run against him.
I wish you would. I wish you would, Dad. I would. Oh.
There are things in here that are unobjectionable because they're not that effective. So, yeah, sure, I'll vote for a distinctive license plate. Sure, why not?
Jim, you had your press conference at 4 o'clock.
You're having a press conference now?
That's right, I'm having a press conference.
Well, is this your space here or is it public?
No, it's my space.
Oh, this is your
space.
Don't
interrupt. Okay.
I'm David Lombardo, and this is the Capital Confidential podcast. This episode features an interview with Ken Levitt, Senior Vice President of Communications and Albany Director of Metropolitan Public Strategies. Our conversation dealt with his time covering the Capitol for the New York Post and Daily News. We talked about the realities of writing for a tabloid, the challenges of producing a weekly column chock-filled with scoops, and the time his tonsils were removed. Enjoy the show.
How did you end up at the New York Post, and was it someplace you always wanted to work?
It was.
Why?
But, you know, I grew up in Long Island, so I grew up reading the New York Post, the Daily News, the Times, and Newsday. And my goal was always to get to a New York City paper. And I thought the Post was lively, the Daily News was lively. I love Newsday. That was my hometown. I grew up delivering it. I had been working at the Capitol for about 4.5 years for a small organization, Ottaway News Service. And we fed Capitol coverage for 3 upstate papers, mm-hmm. Middletown, Plattsburgh, and Oneonta. And I left for about 7.5 months. I went down to New Jersey to the Bergen Record, and an opening happened at the State Capitol Bureau at the Post. And so Greg Birnbaum had been in that position, and he had left to go cover the Hillary race. He ended up becoming the political editor for the Post after a while. And so this is when Hillary was in 2000, when she was running for U.S. Senate out of New York. So I applied. I knew Fred Dicker. We talked back and forth, and ultimately I got the job, and it turned out to be a great, great experience.
So when you talked about wanting to work for New York City paper, the New York Times wasn't one of the ones you just named. Was that not on something you wanted to do, or did you not consider them like a New York City paper?
No, I mean, obviously, you know, I'll tell you, when I got the job at the Post, I called my uncle, and the first thing I told him, yeah, I'm going to be working for the New York Post, and he said, when are you going to work for the New York Times? No, of course, I have the utmost respect for the Times, but... at that time, you know, with the experience I had, I just didn't think it was realistic at that time. You know, I did like the livelihood, the liveliness of the tabs, I did. I always thought, and especially having worked there for now 19 years for 2 of them, I found that the journalism was the same for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the writing was different and you write much shorter, but the stories I was uncovering were stories that could have been for the New York Times. The writing was obviously different. But you also got to do the fun side of things. And so it was
What's the fun side of things?
You know, I spent 2 weeks in 2000, I think it was, writing about Bruce Springsteen when he wrote a song about Amadou Diallo.
Okay.
And he unveiled it in a concert in Atlanta right before he was coming to New York City for a 10-day stand. And I saw it on some blog, and I was like, Springsteen, Amadou Diallo? Yeah, that's worthy of a story. I wrote it. And New York City went crazy. The cops went crazy. There were protests. And, you know, he wasn't going to be performing in New York for about 2 weeks. It was a break in the mm-hmm. tour. And so for 2 straight weeks, there were protests. The cops were doing stuff. So I was writing about that. And, I would have friends come up to me. How does it feel to know your hero hates you now? But, it was fun. And, you know, you got to do some of the lighter stuff. You know, you didn't... People hear tabloid, they think, you know, Bigfoot. But, it wasn't that. And, We did do quality journalism, and we did break a lot of things, both at the Post and the Daily News. So,
and you mentioned that you had a relationship before you came to the Post with Fred Dicker, who I believe was the state editor at the time. Well, what was it like to work with Fred, and was it an experience that you enjoyed?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't very close with Fred before I got to the Post, and you know, I respected him, of course, but you know, we didn't really have a relationship. We knew each other, but and I didn't know what it would be like to work for him, because I knew his reputation. He was tough. He was abrasive. But as a boss, he was much different. He basically just let you do your thing, and as long as you were doing your thing, he was happy.
Did you share that little, like, glass enclosed space with him?
Yeah, no, and he did a show. I was on a show a lot of times. And, you know, I wouldn't say we were socially close, or you know, but we were definitely colleagues, and we respected each other, and he let me do my thing, and, you know, I enjoy it. My time at the Post, I was there for a little over 8 years, is probably some of the most fun I had in journalism, just because of the scope of stories I got to cover.
And so the Post obviously has a sort of an angle to its editorial coverage. Did that impact your reporting anyway, or the way you wrote about stories? Because, I mean, it seems like there's at least lively language in the stories that I see, like with Bernadette's when I read it now. Did you have the same thing? Did the editorial impact you? Editorial angle impact you at all?
No, it really didn't. And I know the reputation. I think if you were going to say it, maybe more for the national stuff. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was get the bad guys. It was, I guess, the attitude, whether they were Democrat, Republican, and you know, it always bothered me when I was at the Post, because everyone would say, "Oh, the Post, they wear their ideology on their sleeve," and I always felt, "Well, so does the Times." You know, the Times has their issues that they like to play up. They do it in a more highbrow fashion. But, you know, there's certainly issues that they work on that are important to them. And I'm not saying they slant it by any means. I mean, you know, like I said, New York Times is one of the greatest papers in the world. Mm-hmm. But they have their issues that they like to play up. And the Post certainly did as well. But I never really had that. No one ever told me, don't write that, or don't, you know, that's too Democrat, or that's too blue. It just wasn't like that, at least in Albany for me.
You're there during 9/11. What role did you play in the Post's coverage at that time?
Well, just to back up a little bit. So in 2000, I got there, and a couple months later was the recount, the presidential mm-hmm. recount. And I went down there, and it was me and Greg Birnbaum, who I mentioned before.
Why'd they send their state reporter down to Florida?
Politics. You know, we're the politics reporters. And so Greg and I were the two down there. We were down there for probably about 3.5 weeks. And I remember saying to Greg at one point, wow, this is going to be the biggest story we cover in our career. And he says, you think so? I said, of course. The selection of a president like this, it hasn't happened in over a century. You know, this will be in our obits. And I go, well, you know, we'll cover media events that are bigger. Like, you know, OJ was a bigger media event, but nothing this important. And, you know, he said, okay. And then, of course, a couple months later, 9/11 hit, and so I never made that prediction again.
So what was it about 9/11 that you were involved in doing?
Well, the first day, you know, so the plane hits. I remember I was going into the Capitol, and I was walking up with someone who worked for the Senate, Sally. She's retired now. And one of the sergeant of arms said to me, you know, a plane hit the Twin Towers. I wasn't even thinking terrorism, so I made a joke. Well, I guess I could take today off, because that's going to be the big story of the day. I just thought it was an accident. Mm-hmm. By the time I got to my office on the third floor of the Capitol, the second plane had hit, and I was like, wow. And there was no communications with the Home Office because of all what was going on, so I got an email from them, and all it said was go to Boston, because that's where the planes left from. So for the first week, I was in Boston, and I was interviewing family members of those who were on the plane, and I was interviewing, you know, authorities, and really just running around. And, you know, I remember going to Logan Airport and the first day or two, and first of all, it was empty, and my hotel room overlooked Logan, and there was no planes, which was crazy. And then you go in, and there were people walking around with submachine guns, which, you know, now is a little more common. You go some places, but there it was, you know, took you back. You hadn't seen that in this country. And so so the first week there, it was tough. You know, I remember it happened on a Tuesday, and I remember Bob Dylan's new album was coming out, and all I was going to do is on my lunch hour go get it. And I'm driving over to Boston instead, and I'm listening on the radio, and there were so many unsubstantiated reports. So you hear, you know, the first tower went down, then the second tower, and then you heard the State Department was on fire, and that there was a car bomb at the White House, and there was all these things. And you're like, what is going on out there? Then I got word that Jane Swift, the governor at the time of Massachusetts, was doing a press conference in Springfield. So I diverted over. And Jane Swift is giving this press conference. And she's like, it's, you know, there's no reason to believe Massachusetts is a target. Go about your business. It's primary day. Go vote. Go shop. And in the meantime, she's in an underground bunker. And so I thought that was ironic. But I go to Boston and I interviewed all these people. And I'm not someone who got emotionally attached very often to things I did. You know, you saw, as a journalist, some horrific stuff, you know, over the years. You know, I covered a lot of murders and fires and fatal fires. But I noticed that I was able to focus really hard during the day in 9/11. But I would wake up and I would literally break down for about 10, 15 minutes in the morning in my hotel room. And it hit me that basically I wasn't processing all this stuff that was coming into me. And then at some point during that day, you know, in the morning, I would just kind of let it go, or, you know, let it out. And then I would go and finish my job. You know, that was a weird experience for me. So I was there for about a week, which was crazy. And I went home for a weekend. And when I went there, by the way, I had no clothes. I had no, you know, anything. And for the first few days, I didn't even try. I just wore the same stuff over and over. And after about 3 days, I started getting a little ripe. Yeah. And so I ran to the mall and I got, you know, a change of clothes. And so then I went home about a week later for 2 days. And then I went down to New York City. One of those days, I went to Ground Zero. And I remember someone telling me, it's going to be so much bigger than you expect. And thinking, it looks pretty bad on TV. They said, TV doesn't do it justice. I said, it looks pretty bad. So I went in, and it was. It was just like in the middle of, like, I can't even describe it. But you're seeing through buildings. You're seeing remnants of buildings. You're seeing, you know, there was this metallic smell that every time, you know, it's, you know, that still, to this day, I can smell sometimes. And I went around and, you know, just horrific. And one thing that struck me, and when I was in there, because I snuck in, I wasn't allowed in, you know, one of the rescue workers says...
Snuck into where? This, the area?
To the area, okay. And to the actual site, the okay. actual...
what was involved in sneaking in?
Getting by a crew, you know, there was like entranceways. But one guy goes, if you're going to be in here, you need a helmet. So he gave me a hard hat, a white hard hat. So the next night, the one thing that struck me, I do tend to be an optimist on things, and, you know, even when it's hard in that case, but the one thing that struck me was watching all these rescue workers and volunteers doing, you know, God's work. and I went back the next night with my helmet, and I stood outside. I didn't go back in. And I went up to people, and I remember saying to them, because I didn't have kids at the time, but I knew sometime I'm going to have to just, you know, explain this and try to find something that I wanted to make positive. And so I went up to all these different, you know, doctors and nurses and policemen and firefighters, and there was a crew. They called themselves the Gumbo Crew. They were out in Louisiana watching the rescue on, you know, like the rest of the country watching it on TV, and they saw one of the rescue workers eating a McDonald's hamburger, and they said, that's not right. And they made these two giant vats of gumbo. They loaded it onto their truck. They drove straight to New York City, and they dished it out for however long for free to the rescue workers and recovery workers, and then they left. And so I went back that next night, and I had all these people sign my helmet. And I said to them, I've interviewed, and it was good, I've interviewed presidents, I've interviewed governors, I've interviewed ballplayers, entertainers. I've never asked for an autograph. I said, but what you guys are doing here. And so, you know, some of them put messages on, you know, Stay Strong America. Some of them didn't, but I still have that helmet, you know, 18, 19 years later. And that really means a lot to me.
That kind of reporting that, I guess, not traditional political reporting, is that something that you missed, you know, working for the Post and the News, covering politics mostly? Or did you always want to do political writing?
Originally, I wanted to do sports.
And so how'd you make that
transition? I actually covered the Yankees and the Mets. After my freshman year in college, I went to University of Buffalo. I got an internship with a radio station on Long Island. I don't even know if it exists anymore, WGSM. And I got to cover the Yankees and Mets home games. And I would go and I'd be in the dugout before the game, in the field. I'd be in the locker room after. I'd be in
what
the press box. 1985.
Were they any good then?
The Mets were on the verge of winning the World Series the next year. The Yankees had good hitting but not pitching. But dealing with ballplayers kind of taught me that I love sports. I like it as an outlet, and I didn't want to do it for a living because I just would have ended up hating it. And I always liked politics, and so I just started focusing on that. But it's funny, because when I worked for Ottawa, when I left Ottawa after 4.5 years of covering the Capitol, I was saying, I'm tired of dealing with everyone who has an angle, and everyone who has, you know, I wanted to deal with real people. And so I went to the Bergen Record, and I was covering real people, and I quickly scurried back to the cocoon of the Capitol.
Yeah.
And then I never looked back. I mean, you know, I was at the Post and the News from 2000 till this year, so.
Well, and how did you end up at the Daily News?
They came for me. Ironically, I had interviewed with them
years
before. No, I did. You know, one thing about the Post, I really thought I would retire there, you know, before the industry mm-hmm. changed the way it was. And I really was enjoying it. And I, you know, I told them, you know, 9/11, I enjoyed it. But, you know, to be part of that story, to be part of the recount, the Terry Schiavo Right to Life case, a Right to Die case, I was down in Florida for 10 days for that at the end. You know, so I got to do a lot of fun, interesting things. And I just really was never looking to move. It was the first job I had that I wasn't looking for my next step. And the Daily News, after Spitzer imploded and Patterson took over and there was all this controversy, the Daily News came and asked if I'd be interested in working for them. And I really wasn't. I remember saying to my wife, I'll talk to them, but why would I leave a paper that really cares about Albany and puts a lot of resources into it for a paper that admittedly for 2 decades didn't care? And they told me that. They admitted that they just didn't, it wasn't on their radar. And they were making nice promises, but I was like, yeah. But I listened. And they kept upping it, and I'm not talking just money, but they're, we'll let you hire a second person, and we'll let you do this. And I saw they were, and I remember driving around. And a matter of fact, I might have been in front of the TU building in 87. I was driving around on a Saturday. They gave me a couple of days to think about it. I told the Post that I was, you know, I had this offer. And they said, well, think about it. And they made a counter. And they said, take a few days, take the weekend, but let us know by Sunday. Because I knew if I took it, I wouldn't be back at work on Monday, because we were competitors. And I had always, my entire career was driven by my gut, that if it felt right, do it. If you had to really anguish over it, don't do it, because it doesn't seem like the right thing. This was the one exception, and I anguished, and for days I was going back and forth. And finally, I just looked at my wife, we were on 87, I just said, screw it, I'm going to take it. You know, I was going to be the bureau chief. Had Fred Dicker told me that he was going to retire in a year, I probably would have stayed with the Post. But he didn't know what his long-term plans were. And so I just decided it would be fun to take over a bureau of my own and try that. And so I did.
What was appealing about the idea of being a bureau chief? Was it just like running a show? Was it working with other reporters?
Yeah, I think all of that. Mm. You know, running a show, working. You know, I got to hire Glenn Blaine, which I think was a really, really good hiring.
Terrible mistake.
Yeah.
And we
worked together for a lot of years. And, you know, that was a great experience. I got to work with Bill Hammond. I got to work with Liz Benjamin for a short time. She was there. And you know, Hammond was just smart. I always respected him. But really, when him and Glenn, I just had a blast working with. And but, you know, there were differences. When I went to the Daily News, it was a hard decision, and I thought the biggest challenge was going to be going up against Fred, because, you know, he was an institution. Mm. But I was wrong. The real biggest challenge wasn't Fred, although it was a formidable challenge, but the real challenge was what I really didn't think about was the irrelevancy of the Daily News in Albany at the time. Mm. And so I think when people had a certain kind of story, they would come to us at the Post. And if they had another kind of story, they'd go to the New York Times or they'd go to the Times Union. But no one ever thought of the Daily News. And I would say the first year, year and a half or two, was spent really trying to change that and trying to make it into a bureau that people said, yeah, we got to get to. Well,
and as one of your competitors, I mean, by the time I'm at the Times Union last year, but, you know, working in Albany, I definitely had the perspective that the Daily News was the place that got a certain type of scoop. I mean, if there was a Monday where your column didn't have, you know, something about what the governor's office was going to do, and also maybe a blind quote about the governor's office shitting on somebody, I wouldn't be surprised. So, yeah, I mean, you definitely turned that, changed that dynamic.
It took a lot. I appreciate that. It took a lot of work. It really did. And the irony was, while we were doing that, you know, me and Glenn and Bill and Liz, the Post hit a point where they stopped caring as much. So it turned into the right, once Fred left. So I think it turned into the right decision. And I always say I was probably the most proud of the journalism I did at the Daily News in my career. And I probably had the most fun at the Post.
What in particular were you proud about at the Daily News?
Well, I did the Alan Hevesy scandal. You know, that really started with the Post, and then it transferred with me over to the Daily News. But breaking a lot of those stories and really finding a lot of stuff, that was really fun reporting for me because it was all records. It was some sourcing, but also a lot of it was records and just going through documents. And it was fun, and it lasted, and it led to arrests, and it led to people paying major fines. So I think I was really proud of that. The Moreland Commission stuff that I broke, you know, that Cuomo was interfering with this anti-corruption commission because it was starting to look at him. You know, I had a lot of those stories first, and that I was really proud of. And you know, and look, there was a lot of battles. You know, my daughters knew on Sunday there was probably going to be a good chance I'll be fighting with Melissa DeRosa, like screaming fights. I used to joke that I fight with her more than I fought with my wife.
What went into making the column on Monday? What were your Sundays like?
Sunday, I worked 6 days a week.
Right.
I never missed a column. I had it for 7 years, and I never missed one, even vacation. The dumbest one was probably, I was having surgery, nothing serious, but it was on a Wednesday or Thursday. It was on a Thursday. And that Wednesday, I wrote a column for Monday.
Right.
Figuring, all right. And it was basically about how Michael Bloomberg, who was mayor at the time of New York City, wasn't putting his money where his mouth is when it came to gun control. He was Mr. Gun Control, but he was supporting a lot of Republicans for U.S. Senate who were NRA highly rated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. I thought that was interesting. So I did it, and I figured, okay, I got my column, I'm done. So I'm on the gurney waiting to go in, and there was like an hour delay. So, I'm on my phone reading stuff. And Bloomberg that day endorsed Scott Brown for his U.S. Senate bid, who was also NRA highly rated. And I'm thinking to myself, this column's not going to hold. Someone's going to put two and two together and write this. So I called the desk from the gurney, and I was having my tonsils out is what I was having. And I said, the column's not going to hold. Can you just have Glenn add a line in about Scott Brown endorsement and his NRA rated? And then, just run it as a regular story. And they did. So I got out of the hospital on Saturday. And that Sunday I woke up, I was still on painkillers. And I reported out an all-new column for about 8 hours.
What was your wife's reaction to that?
She thought I was an idiot.
Yeah.
Not the first time.
I know my wife gives me crap when I'm like doing stuff at like 2 a.m.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah. But I did it, and then I felt like I was going to collapse. I was like, if I was going to do one that I should have taken off, it was that one.
Wow.
I don't even remember what the column was now, that particular one, but it was probably drug-addled. But it made it.
Is there a lot of, I mean, how much pressure did you feel writing that column, not just to create it, but to make it relevant every Monday?
There was a lot, because it wasn't an opinion column. It was a news column for the most part. Sometimes I did analysis, but for the most part, it was a news column. You know, you tried to take stuff that maybe didn't warrant a major story, but you can break it up. And usually the column had 3 or 4 items.
Yeah,
So those always all had to be reported out. And as we were losing members of our staff over the years, the Daily News, editors would want you to write. So a lot of times I always used to try and write a Friday. I was rarely successful. But they would say, what do you got for Saturday? Well, I'm working on the column. Yeah, but what do you got for Saturday? And I'm like, the column counts. It just doesn't appear. I got to work it. And then, so there was a lot of pressure. And then when Fred stopped his column, because he had a Monday column, he really started it. When he stopped his column, everyone said, oh, the pressure must be off. But I felt just as much because I felt like you still wanted it to be good. And I always use the expression, there's that old saying, I hate having, I hate writing, but I love having written. That's how I really felt about the column. I loved the column on Monday. Hated it leading up to it, though, because it was a lot of pressure. And it was a lot of fights because, there was a lot of negative stuff on Cuomo. There was a lot of negative stuff on the ledger, whoever it was. And, so there was a lot of fighting on Sundays. And, the Cuomos, if they're against you, you get a call from the governor, you get a call from Melissa DeRosa, it's, you're going to go toe-to-toe.
There was always a lot of, anonymous quotes in some of these things, or they'd be like somebody in the governor's office commenting on something, or the Senate Dems weighing in on things. How do you decide when to give someone that freedom to, you know, take a hatchet to somebody anonymously.
You know, it's like the definition of pornography. You know it right. when you see it. And there were times where someone would give me something like a quote so over the top where I'm like, I'm not going to. I said, you want that in there, you got to put your name to it. For the column, I gave it a little more free rein, but not. I still held it to a standard. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to let you. It had to be related to the issue. It had to, you know, it couldn't be over the top personal.
Okay.
And so there were times where I just wouldn't run them. But, you know, it was funny. I remember one of the last days when I was at the Daily News, I was in the car with my kids. And it, like I said, you know, I mean, and I had a very good relationship. I wouldn't say I had a great relationship with the governor himself, but I had, I think he respected what I did, but I don't, you know, we weren't even that friendly. But I had a good relationship with his staff, and we fought hard. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's what we do. But whenever certain people would call, and I had my kids in the car, I would always answer the phone and say, you know, oh, you know, my kids are in the car, you're on Bluetooth. And they would know not to swear. One day, one of the last weeks I was there, I got a call from one of them. And before I could even give that announcement, I quickly took it off Bluetooth.
He's rich. And
I quickly took it off Bluetooth and, you know, and I, you know, finished the call and hung up, and my oldest daughter was in the seat next to me, the front seat next to me, and she looks at me and smiles and goes, you work with some really nice people. But they were so ingrained in my family life because of the weekends mm-hmm. that when my niece, who happens to be named Melissa, moved to California, I said to my youngest, who was 9 at the time, I said, you know, oh, Melissa's moving to California. She said, DeRosa?
Yeah.
So, you know.
Also, so how did you go about cultivating relationships for these people who become your sources? And how did you maintain them, the sources, when you inevitably would write stories that they hated?
Some you lost, some you didn't. You know, when Cuomo first got in, I think it took them a good 2 years, him and them, to realize I didn't have an agenda. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately that's what helped me throughout my career at the Capitol. I think people recognize that they may not like what I'm writing, but it's not coming from a personal agenda on my part. I'm not looking to hammer you. I always used to tell the Cuomos, especially early on, you know, you do good, you get good. You do bad, you get bad. You get hit. And they didn't understand that at first. And so the first year they were in, I remember I got frozen out for probably 6-7 months. I mean, it was bad to the point where I would email and call their office every day mm-hmm. if I had a story. And they wouldn't comment. If they had to comment, they'd either send me something snarky or they would contact Glenn Blaine and say, what does Lovett want? And Blaine would say, well, why don't you ask Lovett?
Yeah.
And it went on like that, where they just wouldn't return calls. And you know, my thinking was, it's not going to intimidate me. It frees me, actually, because I don't have to fight with you over this stuff. But I will always get my stories. You know, I was shut out by the Cuomos. I was shut out by Shelley Silver twice for multiple months. I was shut out by Bruno.
Why were you shut out by Shelley?
Shelley, there was one I did a story where he flipped. You literally flipped that where the at a press conference where the Times actually wrote about it. I did a story about how the man who was single-handedly blocking tort reform efforts, the firms that he had worked for over the last decade, won $3 billion worth of judgments. And I, you know, had a lot of lists. I did a lot of digging in terms of court filings for his two firms. And I remember we were at a press conference the day that story popped. I was at the Post at the time. And I said, do you think it... And because the head of the Medical Association of Nassau County said it's a conflict of interest and he should either recuse himself on the issue or step down as speaker. And so I asked him that. I said, do you think it's a conflict? And he says, no, I think you being here is a conflict. Rupert Murdoch, he's the blah, blah, and he went after Rupert. And then at one point he was talking to a reporter and one of his members said to me, Ken, this isn't the time. And I said, with all due respect, Assemblywoman, I'm going to ask him whatever I need to ask.
Yeah.
And he whipped around and he says, what was that? What was that? I can't hear you, Ken. And he kept punctuating the K. You know, you're interrupting your colleagues, Ken. And I really thought he was going to, you know, throw a punch. And he didn't talk to me for a good couple of months, and then it kind of softened. And then the other time I wrote about his finances, off his, he had all these blue chip stocks that had contracts with the state. And the problem at the time was you didn't know if he had $10 worth of stock or $500,000, because right. you know the filings wouldn't show that at the time. And so he didn't. We had a front page. I was at the Daily News at the time. It said Shelley's Gold, and it had him with all this gold, and he was really mad at that. So yeah, you just do it. And I always told people, you could stop talking to me, but I'm still going to get my stories. And so like when the Cuomo thing ended, it just ended. I called down one day a story I was working on. I was doing my perfunctory call, and all of a sudden, Josh Lasto at the time, who was their communications guy, picks up. Hey Ken, how you doing? Like I spoke to him yesterday. It just and we never spoke about it. It just ended, and that was it.
And yeah, you talk about not needing access, you know, to get a story, be frozen out. You still have stories. So what went into your daily routine for developing stories on a day where you know didn't necessarily know what you were going to write about? Is it just making a round random round of calls to people who've been helpful in the past? I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, you make calls to different people. You know,
and who do you call and can I have their numbers?
A lot of times, the news dragged you along. Mm-hmm. You know, something would happen that day, so you had that. But when I was reporting, when I'm reporting the column or there were issue stories, there were series. Yeah, I did a big nursing home series one year with the Post, looking at the nursing home reports and doing that. I did on not for profits. You know, sometimes it was just data research. Sometimes it was most of the time that was just calling, making a round of calls and talking to people, and just. Just doing your due diligence, you know, your gumshoe work.
Do you like it better when the legislature was in town or not in town?
Both. You know, it's funny because by the end of session, I used to be like, I can't wait for them to go. My least favorite weeks of the year were always the last week of the budget and the last week of the session. Because you're sitting there, you know, behind closed doors, and you're just, you know, doing a lot of running around for not a lot of yield until the very end. And then you're there overnight. And I just never really enjoyed that much. But I always used to say, I can't wait for them to go. I can't wait. And then by 3 or 4 days later, I'd be bored out of my gourd. I'm like, I wish they were back.
Any regrets from your career or things you wish you'd gotten a chance to do?
I got to tell you, I think one of the reasons it's been easy for me to walk away from it was, A, the shifting of the industry, the changing of the industry in a direction I'm not really fond of.
What do you mean by that?
You know, fewer people, I think, you know, the Daily News last year, and we're not alone, certainly we weren't alone, laid off half its staff, including Glenn here in Albany, and it became more of a churn, you know what I mean? I wasn't able to report as much. I was still breaking stories because people still came to me, but I wasn't finding stories the way I was, and that to me was always the payoff, that was the fun of it. And
you don't have the time to sit and dig through records.
You don't have the time, no, because you've got 3, 4, or 5 stories to write. So I just wasn't enjoying that as much anymore. And I just think that I got to do what I wanted to do for 30 years. You know, this is what I wanted to do since I was a kid. And to be able to look back and say, you did it, and I wanted to work for a New York City paper. I worked for two. I wanted to work, you know, I wanted to make a mark for myself. I feel I did. So I wish I had more time, and I wish the industry hadn't disintegrated. You know, I keep saying, but I really mean it. It's cliche, but I really mean it, that I didn't leave journalism. I kind of felt it left me. And I could have started again and tried to go to Washington, but I have a family now, and I've done it. And I just didn't feel the desire to start over again.
Was D.C. ever appealing to you, while maybe when you were younger?
I think when I was younger, there were 3 beats I wanted. I wanted New York City Hall, I wanted Albany, and I wanted Washington. Mm-hmm. I wanted the main... but it would have been hard, you know. Going down to D.C. for certain papers, you're a small fish. And, you know, covering City Hall or Albany for a New York City paper, you're a big fish.
Right.
And I like that. If the opportunity, though, presented itself, I probably would have enjoyed doing it. But I don't look back at that and say, well, I never got to do that. You know, it wasn't like I was dying to do it. Because if I really wanted to do it, I could have.
Were there ever opportunities?
Yeah, within papers that I was at, and also where there were openings, but I never sought them. Yeah, I like the Capital Region. I really do, and we've made our lives here, and I feel at home here, and I feel I did it. You know, I feel very lucky that not many journalists today get to go out on their own terms. Mm-hmm. And the way I looked at the area, I said, you know what, I'm not going to retire in this field, and whether it's a year or 2 or 3 years, you know, I know it's coming. And I wanted to find something that at least interested me and go out on my own terms than rather than have to find a job and have to say, you know, under the governor's leadership, because I had to take a job right. to feed my family. So the timing was right. I was really surprised at how little I've missed it. I thought I would really miss it a lot because it was my identity for 3 decades.
Well, what sort of adjustment has there been in the new role?
Not a big one in terms of, you know, the adjustment is just learning certain things and you know, now being more of an advocate, I guess.
Do you ever feel uncomfortable in that role?
I haven't yet. You know what I mean? Could
you imagine that being uncomfortable in certain things, if it's a certain issue or something?
Maybe. But it hasn't happened so far in all the whole 6 months I've been there. You know, I'll cross that bridge. But, you know, there were things that I wrote that I wasn't always thrilled with.
Is it tough to pitch reporters, especially if there's maybe something where you feel like, I don't know if I'm selling this to somebody, but maybe it's not the greatest story in the world or whatever?
I tell, and I've said it to you, and I've said it to everyone. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to pitch you stories that I think are legitimate stories. And if I'm pitching you something that I think is a lesser story, I'm not going to pitch it like this is a front page story.
Anything that could happen that could theoretically bring Ken back into the world of journalism?
It would be hard. I'm enjoying what I'm doing, but B, it would be hard. I don't think the industry is looking for me right now. You know, you brought up the Times. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Times. They just bought out a bunch of people who are in their 50s, you know, so they want younger too. It's a different field right now.
Okay. Well, Ken, thank you so much for being so reflective and taking the time to walk me through some of your CV.
Oh, it was great. Anytime.
Thanks.
And that's our show. My thanks to Ken Lovett for joining me and reflecting on part of his career in Albany. He'll be back next week to talk about his time as the LCA softball pitcher and his favorite Bruce Springsteen songs. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us and leave a review wherever you download podcasts. It helps other people discover the program and gives me a reason to keep living. And I want to give a shout out to Hearst's new DC reporter, Emily Munson. Follow her on Twitter at EmilieMunson, and hopefully we'll have her on the podcast in the future to talk about life in the halls of American power. Thanks for listening, and until next time, podcast adjourned.
Just heard, I tried to get you.
Ah, this day sucks.